and welcome to the Crate and Crowbar. This is episode 108. It's the 1st of September. I'm Tom Francis, and with me here today are...
Marsh Davis, hello.
Thompson Senior, hello.
And...
Chris Thurston, hello.
And special guest, Tim Wicksteed.
Hello.
I didn't let you say your own name for some reason. I interrupted you. Tim is the creator of... Sorry, the... What would you say? Designer and programmer?
I like creator. It makes me sound like Peter Molyneux.
So you want the prize.
Uh-huh.
All the credit for Big Pharma, which is a cool game that came out on Steam last Thursday.
That's right.
At 3 p.m. I've just learned.
Yeah, completely deliberately, and not because of a cock up at all.
And it's a... Actually, you should give the basic summary.
I want to talk about. I kind of would prefer you did, Tom.
Well, yeah, I can give it a go. I also want to talk about playing it. So.
All right, no, I'll give you the basic summary. So it's a game all about running your own pharmaceutical company. And that kind of entails importing ingredients from far-flung destinations into your factory and then running those ingredients through a series of tortuously designed production lines made from conveyor belts and machines. And then hopefully you convert those ingredients into... finished products which have some kind of curative property and not too many side effects, and then you sell them for a profit.
Cha-ching.
It's very, like, it's isometric, and it's got a very lovely art style where everything's sort of... I'm not quite sure how to describe it. I guess it's a bit like a diagram, like from an instruction manual or something.
Interesting, yeah.
But,
you've got
but
the
colourful.
Grid lines in the background. It's kind of blueprinty. People said when they first saw kind of screenshots that it had a little bit of Portal 2...
Yeah, definitely.
Kind of vibe.
The map maker style.
Yeah,
kind of
that's exactly.
Are
they
3D models that you use, or are they sprites taken from 3D models? Or?
The second one.
Right.
Yeah.
Ah.
So yeah, 3D models, animated purely in 3D, and then rendered out into 2D, and then brought into After Effects for like additional post processing.
Oh right, okay.
And this isn't me. This is my artist, who also happens to be my brother, who's Rob Wicksteed. Shout out to him. But yeah, so it's kind of a strange style that can only come about from using like a mixture of 3D and 2D.
It's really nice. It looks very clean and crisp. And like you say, diagrammatic as well.
I didn't... This is a terrible reflection on me as a human being, I think, but I didn't notice for ages that there were any people in it at all. Like, you place these machines, you place conveyor belts on machines, and it turns out that many of the machines, maybe all of the machines?
Not all of them, but many, yeah.
Some of them have a person standing there working it, and I'm just completely blind to this. I'm so focused on the mechanics of the game and how to make drugs better that I haven't noticed there are any people on my shop floor at all. And I didn't notice until I wanted to reorganise a production line, and... you can move things around for free, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is it free? Good. Because I've been doing it a lot.
it's free.
Which is better than selling it and buying it again later if you happen to need it. So I've sectioned off a bit of my workshop. What do you call it? Warehouse? Production?
Yeah, I often call it warehouse. Yeah, factory's good.
My factory to be basically a warehouse where I just store all the things that I'm not using at the moment but I might need it one day, and they're all just sitting there unconnected. And then I noticed that the guy just standing at one of the machines just connected to nothing, and it's like facing the wall.
He's got all these people, he's slaves, just kind of standing there. He can't go home to their families.
The other thing I didn't realise until quite far in was that every sort of move of the conveyor belt, everything moves kind of, it's almost like turns, but they're very, very fast.
Yeah.
And you know, things go along in these discrete steps.
Yep.
Each one of those is a day.
Yes.
And so that guy was there for like 6 months.
It's so true. It's actually one of the things, I kind of glad you brought it up, what things I really like in the game, and it's something I really wanted to put it in a game. It's this thing where it's really discreet, like you say, so each square can hold, you know, a belt, and each belt can hold a drug, and you have this weird thing where the drug at the very front can't move until the drug at the very... Wait, other way around. The drug at the back can't move forward unless the drug at the front can move.
Mm.
And it's kind of like pushing marbles down a tube, and there's just something really beautiful about like watching everything just shift in one go, and really like galling when for some reason there's an inefficiency and like there's a bottleneck and all of your drugs stop moving, and like half your drugs move and then a few don't, and you're like, there's something wrong. And it kind of jars against you and you see it. Kind of cool.
I find that if you screw something up, if you get the machines in the wrong order and some process doesn't work out the way you thought it was going to work out, you end up often negating the good effects of your pill and sometimes leaving in the bad effects. And then that gets to the end of the production line and it wants to leave the factory.
Yeah.
And often I've screwed up because I'm modifying an existing production line. And so when this pill gets to the exit... The game recognises that I've invented a new drug. It's the one I haven't ever released before. And you can't, it can't leave the factory until you give it a name. So it pops up and says, what do you want to call this? And there's a random name generator, which kind of, if the drug actually does something useful, it will name it after that. And if it doesn't do something useful, it will, seems to always involve, like, calling it sugar pills.
Yes.
Even if what it actually does is, like, give you a headache and raise your blood pressure and nothing else.
It's marketing, you know.
And, because I can't, you can actually, I guess you could just sell the conveyor belt it's on, right, and rebuild it. I don't know if that would be efficient to do, but what I end up doing is just, like, I intentionally leave the name as it is because I want to remember later that that was a garbage pill that I shoved out for no reason. I just had to sell it because it was on the production line because nothing else could move forward unless I did. And then, yeah, just let it out into the wild. And it always makes some money. It's always like, oh, well, like, maybe I spent more making it than it yeah, sold for, it'll be... but it'll still sell for, like, $25 or something.
Yeah, and all it does is cause side effects.
I want a expansion pack about the marketing team who had to sell my sugar pills. This, honestly, it doesn't even do nothing. It actually actively hurts me two different ways. It has no benefits.
Double poison. Why sell for poisoning yourself once?
I guess it's the marketing team who decided that the one that, that actively harms you should be called a sugar pill, because that's actually kind of overselling it a little bit.
Yeah, like,
it's not quite as good as a pill of sugar.
I like the idea of, like, you're flogging off these, like, really dangerous drugs just to be used as, like, placebos in a controlled trial. Another piece of sugar pill, sure. And then, like, suddenly the drug that's against this placebo does much better because it's not causing all these side effects.
There are a lot of interesting moral questions around the way big pharmaceutical companies operate, and indeed just the charging marketing things that people need to live, and is it one of those areas where you can do it? And I was wondering if you thought about that during the game, or if it is just, you wanted it to just be a puzzle game, or whether you wanted players to ask themselves questions about that.
Like, number one, I just wanted it to be a really fun game. I'll be honest. In fact, the game started as I wanted to make a factory game. That's the bit that really excited me. And then I came upon this theme and I was like, that could work. And the pharmaceutical theme does add some really interesting things. You've got, like, patents, and stuff like that, and obviously the side effects thing, which is that you wouldn't get in every, if it was just like a generic factory making washing machines or cars or something. But
side effect, washing machine is also a car.
But as I went along, I did start to get a little bit more kind of excited by the kind of the theme, and I'm trying to think what I could do with that. And so, yeah, absolutely. It's a very, like, soft touch, I think, I've tried to design it, where it doesn't kind of try and demonize the industry or kind of say, this is the way I think it should be done, but rather, like, the player can do things, and depending on that, you know, the player's moral compass, they might kind of think, that's a bit... Am I really allowed to do that?
Flood the market with poison, and that's just raw profit.
Get them off my production line. They were jamming things up, damn it. And there's no way to move a pill onto the floor, so... Yeah. Gotta sell them.
I think there's more kind of, like, subtle ones, beyond just kind of, like, the really obvious, like, evil of, say, you know, selling something like loads of side effects deliberately. Mm. There's kind of things like, you know... Can you really blame a profitable business, a profit generating business to, say, release something with a little side effect because it's cheaper than release, you know, like, spend loads and loads extra on removing that side effect and making it the best drug possible, but then, like, literally there's no money in it. Like, what do you expect to happen when you try and, align the goals of, like, curing people and, like, a profit-driven enterprise?
Game systems are some of the best ways of exploring these ideas, because they, when you're in that dilemma, it's just about money, it's just about systems, which is how businesses think and how to turn the profit at the end. Then it does kind of sidelines the morality all of a sudden in an interesting way that is perhaps quite accurate.
Yeah, I've already hit that, actually, when playing it. I think in the tutorial, which might mean I did something wrong in the tutorial, there's a bit where you explain how to change the concentration of a drug to kind of hit a sweet spot where its positive effect will be at maximum strength and its bad side effect will be at minimum strength, which is useful in situations where there's no way to get rid of the side effect, because sometimes you can just get rid of it. But it's quite a lengthy process. You have to do a lot of research to analyze the drug. You have to sort of just burn, like, 50 of your own pills just to find out more about the strength of the effects work at, and then after you've done that, you've got to figure out what the best concentration is, because you have to pick a kind of one concentration value for the whole drug, and if it's got three different effects, then all of them will be at that concentration, and it might be that the ideal concentration for your positive effect is actually quite close to the ideal concentration for your negative effect, in which case you can make it a bit better by making it exactly on the one you want. But yeah, I did that all of that in the tutorial, and it sold for like very, very slightly more than before, but the processing cost of bringing it to that right concentration was way out of whack with that and just made it more expensive. And so you realize it isn't actually a good thing to make this, you know, negative side effect better or, you know, less severe.
Yeah.
And yeah, every time you're actually faced with something like that as a game mechanic, you always have a lot more like appreciation for it, because you realize that like that's not just oh, it's annoying or it's bad for the company or whatever. It also means you just won't produce as much of that drug. And so in any situation where the demand for that drug exceeds the supply, it means that you're actually just helping people less by refining it, you know, by doing it less efficiently so that you lose money. It just means you help fewer people, which is weird.
Yeah. No, absolutely. I love that. I can't believe you got that in the tutorial. That's awesome. Well, you might have done something wrong. It sounds like you've done something right. That's awesome. That's like music to my ears. That's exactly kind of the sort of feels I wanted people to be having when playing the game.
You also get less fraught decisions where I just earlier today, I've been playing this game the entire day, by the way. I haven't done anything else. Yes. I ate lunch at like 4 p.m.
It's just sugar pills. Just shove in sugar.
They give me these headaches. Gotta keep playing. I made a whole huge factory just devoted to producing, I think, migraine medicine. Mm-hmm. It was one of the higher level cures. Okay. And at the time, it was massively profitable. And then I kind of overinvested in it a little bit. And I was way more profitable than my competitor. But I could tell, like, the bottom is going to fall out of this market at some point, and then I'm going to be so fucked. So I was trying to expand into a different drug, and I sent out explorers to different regions of jungle and desert and stuff to find new raw ingredients to bring back for you, and then you get like some property of them, and then you can refine that property and refine it again into new and more powerful effects. And so for each ingredient, basically, there's kind of a top level effect, and nothing that wasn't a top-level effect was going to be anything like as profitable as what I had at the moment. So I needed a new ingredient to find its top-level effect, which requires a lot of like research and stuff. And I had this one thing, I had one ingredient, I couldn't refine it because it needed a certain catalyst, and that catalyst I didn't have on any of my current ingredients, so I had to keep sending out more explorers and finding new ones. And then I found a new ingredient with that catalyst, but it had one positive effect, which I think was... it wasn't treats ADHD, but it was the one below that, version of that.
Antidepressants.
Yes. It had that effect, but then it had three negative effects. So then it produced, like, coughing, bleeding, like high blood pressure or something. And so it was going to be a nightmare to, like, just to get that one catalyst, I'd be adding all of those negative effects to this drug. But then I found that as I started to build a production line with it and process it a few times, it reveals more of the higher level effects. And the highest level effect of that was
bipolar disorder?
Yes, treats bipolar disorder, which was worth a huge amount of money. And so I just set up my production line to remove these three negative side effects. And one of them, like, to get it to that final stage involves increasing its concentration massively. And putting it through like these seven different machines in a certain order, and I did that, but then it had these terrible side effects, and I wanted to get rid of those before I actually went into full production, because it's easier to do it right first time than modify it later. So I needed to remove the first side effect. To remove could only be removed if it's at low concentration, and then you put it through a certain machine. And I thought, oh, that's a pain in the ass, because I've just raised the concentration to get it to this good effect, and now I've got to lower it all the way back down again. That's going to be loads of machines, loads of expense, and ongoing. And then I had a revelation where I realized, earlier on in the process, we temporarily reduced the concentration by one or something, and then we put it through this other thing, and then we increase it all these other times. So at that stage, I took out the negative side effects, it would only take a couple of these machines to do it. I did that, and it worked. But it took a massive amount of space. I spent like half an hour just trying to figure out how to sort of arrange these pieces, because each machine has an input direction and an output direction and takes up a certain amount of space. And you can rotate them, but that still doesn't give you total freedom as to as to fitting them together. It is like Tetris, you know, you get these pieces that are awkward and they don't fit in the right way. And eventually I figured out that in this new building I just bought, there just simply physically wasn't room to do it unless I scrapped one of the pill makers, which means my whole production efficiency would be halved and it would end up being less profitable than my last one. So I left that as is and I'm like, oh, for fuck's sake, all right. Then went to my main factory floor where I had this huge open plan thing that I started with and was producing like 7 different production lines of this one drug.
Yeah.
And I wiped out one of them, like sold everything to make a huge amount of space and then set up the proper production line, got it all ready. And these other two side effects that I was, that were negative, I was getting rid of by, I actually didn't remove them, they just weren't active at the maximum concentration. So I ramped the drug up to the maximum concentration and the good side effect, the good effect was still active at that level. And the others weren't. And I got it all set up and took ages and ages and I sacrificed loads to do it. And then at the end, I thought, I wonder if that other side effect that I have to reduce the concentration to get rid of is actually active at the concentration that I've ended up setting the drug at. And I went back and no, it's not. None of them are. All I have to do is just increase the concentration. It's actually an incredibly simple process. In fact, it's one of the most space efficient and short production lines I've ever had. So I had to go back and just like sell all of those pills.
Oh dear.
And do it all over again.
When you find a new substance, how do you discover its properties?
It's interesting actually, because there is an analyzer machine. I haven't tried just putting it straight into the analyzer, right?
Put it in the analyzer, you say.
So the way I've been doing it is that when you first discover it, it tells you about the first effect, and there's two more effects that you don't know about. And any effect you can see, it'll also tell you how to get the next one, but it won't tell you what the next one is. Mm-hmm. But the process might be really difficult, so it's like put it through this and this and this, and then get to this certain concentration, and then you'll get the new effect, and then only after you've done that can you see the next effect, and only after you've got the next effect can you see what we require for the final effect. And then so I kind of end up building like these short test production lines where it's not going to be a real thing, I'm just putting it through the process just to find out what the next effect is. But if I just built one, just a source and an analyzer, and put it straight into the analyzer, would I find out
only find out about the first cure. You need to then like upgrade it and then analyze that next one. And so what's my kind of attempt there was like, obviously, you don't really want to analyze high-level cure stuff because you've invested lots of processing money into getting it up there, and then you're never actually getting your return from it. So it is kind of the most galling thing to, like, you had to send, I don't know, but you think you're right about kind of 30 to 50 of these things in. And, yeah, when you're, like, when this is something that when you sell it, it could be worth $600 or $700, dollars, pounds, whatever currency you're playing in, that's just like, and you have to put like 30 or 40 of those into this thing, which just eats them. It's actually a huge amount of money. You don't realize, like, cause your ingredients only cost like 30 on their own. So like the level one cures are very easy to analyze, very cheap. And then the high level ones, not so much. That's actually a very divisive machine in terms of the community. Like some people like love it; they think it's really worth it, and then other people just say no, I just ignore it. I'm probably more of the ignorer. I generally just get stuff to the closest concentration. You'll know what I'm talking about here, Tom. Just basically make it for the cheapest. And if the drug turns out to not be very good, well, it doesn't matter. I didn't put much money into the process. You know? So yeah,
I see how it happens, don't you?
That's kind of interesting.
I did use the analyzer on this game, and I kind of swore not to ever again because what it revealed was I was already producing the drug at the exact perfect concentration.
Well, like, that doesn't always happen. And the truth is, like, long term, you can make mega money by using the analyzer because your product has like a reputation, and that grows over time if it's very effective. So you don't see those returns at the beginning, but like if it's one of your early things that you make, by kind of the end of the game, it's going to be like its value will be up like 40% or something, which make a big difference.
Yeah, I had an interesting thing where an old drug that I've been producing for ages, like just on production line, I couldn't be bothered to scrap, had a good effect and a bad effect, and its rating ended up really good. Like it got a really good drug score, and I wondered, do they sort of just like a drug more after it's been on the market a long time because it's well tested? And
so the way it works, like underneath everything, like, you know, under the hood, is basically there is a kind of true value of every product based on how bad the side effects are and how good the cures are. And then it always starts when you start selling it at C, at cure rating C, it goes from F to S+. Somebody asked me, was it a typo that I did S instead of A? Which is kind of like a fair comment. Yeah.
But no, imagine that.
But I like kind of JRPGs and
yeah, it's the Japanese action games. Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
I don't know, so S, it's better than A, it's super, right?
It's, yeah, like... it's like super A.
I don't know if this is the same origin, but in the Korean StarCraft tournaments, there's code S and code A, and code S is the good one, and code A is the less good one.
Yeah, I think it must be same origin, absolutely.
In which case, it's really funny that A is the worst.
Is there no code B?
Well, I don't know. You don't see it, but then I don't see it because I'm seeing the tournament, which is probably the best.
Yeah, that makes sense. I'll finish briefly. And then the more you sell of a product, the closer it asymptotically approaches its true rating. So, like, you can't, unless you use the analyzer, you won't know as soon as you start selling it how good it is. It stops you just trying a load of different things. You have to wait maybe a year, sell 300 of these things before you'll know. So, yeah, the analyzer is like, if you've got the money to burn, it's a good way of getting your production line right first time because, as I know you know, it's expensive to, like, rework things.
Yeah.
You can move bit machines.
My warehouse is huge. Yeah. It's like half my floor space. It's just old machines that I've just stuck
with lonely men standing there.
Yeah. Loads and loads of
and
lonely
women,
men.
Women, equal opportunities employer in Big Pharma.
Yep. Anyway, I'm really enjoying it. It's good.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks. It's great.
We have other news this week. Yesterday?
We do news?
Yeah.
News. That's the news intro.
Thank
you. With an authoritative voice.
There's the Deus Ex pre-order. I don't even know what the noun is for this.
Debacle?
Clusterfumble.
Just
vomit. Oh, that's so depressing. There's a trailer.
Entry in the Fucked It Olympics.
I just heard about this like third hand through Twitter, just people reacting to reactions about it, and wondered what the hell it was, and found the trailer showing what it was, and before I saw anything of the trailer, saw that it has like 80% dislikes on YouTube, which is thousands of people. And this is on like the official Square Enix channel, so they know it hasn't gone down well.
And yeah, my first encounter with it was a chart trying to explain it. I thought, I'm not even going to look.
So it's there's going to be pre-order bonuses, shock. And as usual, well, as is increasingly common, there are just like a whole kind of mess of different things, like unlockable skins for Jensen, some of which look ludicrously ostentatious.
More ostentatious than a floral print trench coat.
Yeah, like gold
in a black and gold apocalypse.
And there's exclusive missions and I think like weapons and stuff. And you have to pick which edition you want from different retailers, and then as the game approaches, the more copies are sold, the more options become available, and you kind of, I guess you must create an account or something, and you like log in and you level up your pre-order and you choose how to augment your pre-order, and you can later on like branch out into different pre-order bonuses. They're trying to make the process, all this pre-order bullshit, into a game itself, so like making it as close as possible to the idea of leveling up and earning rewards and choosing a loadout in a video game, but doing it as these awful bullshit things that just kind of muddy what the game really is, and often are sort of... They're a mix of like things you just really, really don't want and things you really wish they hadn't done. Those are your choices.
That's the box quote. That should be...
The exclusive mission, I do want it. If it's a mission made by the same people as the main game, then I want to play it, but I wish they hadn't done it, because... Now it makes the game, main game feeling complete. Absolutely. And screws you over if you buy from the wrong place, and makes just it like when I'm thinking about how to sell games that I make, the one of the primary concerns is how do I just like make people not think about this bullshit as like make them think about it as little as possible. Like make the buying part of it incredibly short and simple and straightforward, and then the playing part of it can be interesting and complex and deep. And they have taken the opposite approach where they want to like, this seems a system designed to make people spend as long as possible and as much time and attention and thought into how they spend their money on the game and where they should spend their money. And to add insult to injury, one of the pre-order bonuses, if enough people pre-order, is that the game will, they'll get the game 4 days early. Now, I wasn't clear on, is that just the pre-orders get the game 4 days early, or does everyone? It must be just the pre-orders, right?
They seem to imply that it was everyone that like unlocked the game. Like, that's not how that works, is it?
Well, I mean, early loses all like sense if everyone's early.
Yeah,
like, do you know what I mean? It's only early.
Well,
if
otherwise,
someone
you're
else
ransoming
isn't.
It, I guess, against.
Yeah, exactly. That's what like I think whichever way you slice it, it's basically ransoming the game. Yeah. For like, it's really just, because what hasn't happened is that this is enabling them to make the game 4 days faster. Right? None of this is making, none of this is shaving 4 days off the production time.
They're just going to do 4 days.
So what they're actually doing, what their actual policy is, we're going to delay the game for 4 days for everyone else, or perhaps if not enough people buy it, we're going to delay the game to punish you for not buying it.
Yeah.
Which doesn't punish anyone who didn't buy it, because they didn't buy it. They don't give a shit.
Just punishes people who bought it. I mean, just, I totally agree about that, like, confusing people. It's not, I mean, surely that's not going to lead to more sales. Even if you take all the bullshit out of it and you say, like, how are they attempting to just run as a business the most effectively? How are they going to sell the most copies of this thing? It just seems crazy to do a whole, to make different retailers have different bonuses. All you're going to do is just frustrate and put people off making a choice one way or the other.
Well, they must have market data on this, because other games have come out with similar kind of bullshit schemes. Yeah. And you'd think they would have probably asked Warner Brothers, did that go down well for you? And Warner Brothers would, I would have thought, said no. But
maybe it's
but
always maybe going terribly, yes. And they lie. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Really yeah. Deceiving each other.
Yeah, it was a huge PR victory. You should definitely do that. Yeah.
People lap it up.
It's funny, because I think we definitely, on either on this pod or the PC Game Podcast, used to use Human Revolution, previous Deus Ex game, as an example of just a generic example of fairly ordinary pre-order bonuses ruining games. Because that game had pretty standard for games now. Like, you got some guns and some money and some skill points early if you pre-ordered. Yeah. But
which you shouldn't have got at that stage of the kind of difficulty.
It was obviously not a decision that had been made by a game designer, because it was very specifically tuned to fuck up the planned progression of the player's power in that game over time, right? You just got too much stuff too early that was too good. And it undid, like, the first 6 hours of the game.
Yeah, didn't you start with, like, a Trank sniper rifle?
Yeah, if
you,
it was a silenced actual sniper rifle. And in the game, you only get the silenced tranquilizer sniper rifle, which is shit. And it's so fucking hard to take anyone out with it at all. The one you get in the pre-order bonus is just, which you just get for free, just sort of arrives.
It's on your desk, isn't it?
I think it's in your inventory.
Way better
in the beginning.
When I said that it was a tranquilizer sniper rifle, I did, of course, mean that it lethally tranquilized people. That was the side effect, isn't it?
Positive effect, tranquilizes. So, negative effect, does also kill them.
It's also a bullet. It wasn't the most egregious case of it being too confusing, because lots of games have overtaken it since. Like, Evolve obviously overtook it in terms of.
Oh, God, yeah, that was the last major PR disaster, wasn't it?
But it's interesting that they've really made this strident claim to roll out there and put Deus Ex once again at the front of at the front of pre-order bullshit. Terrible. I just don't.
Better news though, God of War 2 free now.
Yeah, talking about a game with a business model that makes no sense to anybody to a game with a business model that made no sense but seemed to work and was brilliant for people. That game is now completely free, which is kind of nuts, because
not even free to play, just free. No.
It already had microtransactions in it, right?
It did. So still there, Guild Wars' model was that it was they called it pay to play,
like a normal game.
Yes, basically it's an MMO, but it's basically a normal game. It cost £35, right, and you could play it for as long as you wanted, forever, with basically very few restrictions. But they made a bit of extra money to pay for the upkeep of the game as an MMO by selling character slots, although you did actually get quite a few. And other than that, it was just boosters and cosmetic stuff, and that was it, really. And now they've basically said, fallen back to the whole thing's free. Just pay for microtransactions and the expansion, which I guess is what they're shooting for. But what's interesting about this is it potentially doubles down on how annoyed the Guild Wars community was. because when they announced the expansion, Heart of Thorns, and they announced that would be, obviously cost money. And that game has had a crazy amount of free updates over its 2 or 3 year life now. Like, that game has been updated a lot for free, far more so than most MMOs that have a subscription thing. So they've really earned their keep, I think, for the first couple of years of the game. But they announced that the expansion was going to be a set amount of money. It would come with the base game, and it would be no cheaper if you already owned the base game.
Yeah.
So it's £30 again or something. I don't actually know what it is. There's only one package to buy. Don't people making it simple?
Yeah.
There is one package to buy, and that's what you spend your money on.
And people hated that, presumably.
They hated that because they felt that
too simple.
because they were, you know, day one players of the base game, and they'd spent money on the base game, they should get money off the expansion.
This is the orange box lesson, I think, where Valve announced, Portal sorry, Portal 1, I was going to say Portal 2, Team Fortress 2 and Half-Life 2 Episode 2 all in one package that was ridiculously, insanely good. And it also came with Half-Life 2 and Episode 1. And originally they were going to do a version that didn't come with Half-Life 2 and Episode 1 and was a bit cheaper, and then they cancelled that. And the final thing was still like $25 or something for three like fucking incredible games. But because you were getting these ones that you already had, people were furious. And at that point, I think...
Even though they let you gift those spare copies to people.
Yeah, yeah, like, gift them. And it was just like, the Orange Box is still one of the greatest deals ever offered to humankind. Like, it's incredible. But I think at that point, I can't remember who it was, someone at Valve said, I think we could put a $10 note in a box and charge $5 for it and still catch some flack. Yeah,
that's a great line.
But yeah, so they've basically now said that Guild Wars 2 is now free. Basically, the base game is worth free. So, you know, if you'd... So those people annoyed that their 30 quid investment isn't translating to a discount on the expansion are now being told, well, actually,
it's not worth anything at all.
2 years and it's not worth anything at all. But, I mean, it's still fucking stupid because they got that 2 years of enjoyment and free updates out of it, and now they could spend some more again to get more of that. But
I feel like if they'd just done that in the other order, they could have got away with it.
Yeah,
if they just said, hey, good news, everyone, Guild Wars, the base game has gone free now. And then next month they say, and the expansion is coming out soon, and it's 30 quid. They don't have to explain who it's 30 quid to, because now everyone's the same.
Yeah.
It's something, because they made it simple, but they made it simple in a way that you also need to explain some hopefully fairly straightforward things to the player base, where it's like, if we divide the player base by splitting this into different versions, that's actively bad for the game you like. Like, that's actually terrible for the type of game this is. Not only that, it's not even, it would be terrible for most MMOs. It's specifically an MMO which is designed to get better the more people are in an area. So, do you divide that community between expansion and not expansion and so on, or do you just give everyone the same thing? It's frustrating, but great for them for making it free, and actually, more to the point, people don't have an excuse not to play it now, because it's still probably the best MMO out there.
I loved Guild Wars 1. I haven't played an MMO since then, really, years ago, for kind of, lack of time, but thoroughly recommend number 2.
It's still the highest review score I've ever given a video game.
Wow.
Yeah, possibly because I've never gone that mad reviewing a game. But no, I think it's brilliant. Like, I think it's one of the few MMOs to get pretty much everything right. Well, for that reason, like, if you want the one reason, it's great, because the combat system's great, and I really love the art, and the world setting is beautiful and it's quite inventive and all the rest of it. The reason it's great is pretty much every recent MMO since World of Warcraft, which is now a decade pretty much, is designed in a way that breaks the more players are trying to do an activity. And that is really bad when your game is a massively multiplayer online role-playing game, because that's the circumstance you're attempting to bring about with the design of the game, which breaks the thing you do in the game. And that, I think, would be just broken game design in almost any other context. But so, you know, in that's people chasing after the same quest objective and having to queue for it. Or, I remember best example is from The Elder Scrolls Online, which was running around waiting for fires to respawn in a burning abbey so that I could be the one to put them out. Which, because if I put all the fires out in the abbey, then, but I wasn't the one who, or if I watched someone else put all the fires out, then the fires are out, but I didn't get the credit for it. So I need to wait. That's obviously bullshit. Guild Wars' system works on a series of basically scaling public events. There are quests and stuff, and if it's a single player quest, it happens in an instant stuff area of the world. If you're in the open world and you see something happening, you will always be rewarded for participating in it, and it will always scale. And whether that's a town being invaded and you run in, and if it detects that there's one player there, it will scale the encounter for one player, and if it detects there are 100, it will scale it for 100.
That's great.
And that's how every MMO should be designed. And now everyone should play it.
As a quick aside, what is the highest score you guys have given Tom and Marsh?
10 for Edge, I think. Orange Box, amongst other things.
Yeah,
that's
right. Yeah. But I couldn't really not give it a 10, because it already got Half-Life 2... Episode 2 had already come out by that point? Or was that with
that
the
That was
box?
With it. So Episode 1 had already come out. We'll see.
Right.
Oh, well, Mr. Slider.
Yeah.
Did you know Episode 1 had come out before Episode 2?
Hot trivia. No, well, because it included a game we'd already given 10 to, I couldn't really give it less than a 10, because it added extra stuff on top as well.
Surely you should have added the scores of the games.
19.
Well, like, seeing as it was $20, which is what you pay for a game on its own.
Yeah, I mean, we...
We did think about giving it 11, I think, but I think we backed away from that.
Yeah.
Because I also reviewed The Orange Box, but we reviewed each of the three games individually, and we didn't give an overall score for the thing.
Hmm.
Which is kind of...
Which would have been the sensible way to do it, I think, probably.
Yeah, that's the litmus test, I think, for whether you're being a buyer's guide to packages people can pay money for, or a review, like, artistic critique of individual works. Because they are individual works, for sure. There's no way... It would be silly to say that they're all one thing. But in terms of, like, telling people whether they should buy it or not, I almost wish we had given it an overall score as well, just so I could... That would surely have been the highest score I'd given... I don't know what the hell you give that, actually.
What you should have done, I wasn't PC Gamer at the time, what you should have done is review every game individually, but then give an actual score to the box. Like the orange box on the title.
The physical
box. Yeah. Right, yeah. Just review the box. Like, it's a functional box. Six.
Yeah. Valve sent us in the post at some point.
Is that 1 point per side?
Yeah.
Sorry. Well, at one point around the orange box's release, Valve sent us an orange box costume. Which was, I mean, literally dressed you up as an orange box. It was like this weird spongy foam thing, bright fluorescent, like that day glow orange. And it was only roughly or cuboid, I guess is the word. And you could fit inside it. And it was horrible. It was like, it just flaked everywhere. And there's bits of orange all across the PC Gamer office for months afterwards.
Can you
like,
tell this is a company that does its own PR? It's to do PR.
Like most of the time, they just don't do anything. But then when they do something, it's really strange.
This is what humans enjoy. Bellows. Valve HQ.
I think my highest score is Bioshock 1, which I think was 94. And that's a good, like, that was a perfect storm of, A, genuinely is probably brilliant, and I certainly wouldn't give it any less today, but also it's like review scores, games benefit in the review score if their appeal is kind of immediate in some way, or like if at the moment you finish the game, your fondness for that game is at a peak, because that's when you're going to be writing a review and scoring it. Mm. And I think more than almost any other game, Bioshock, like, just coming off the kind of Andrew Ryan confrontation thing, it just had like such a high that that like fed into it, I think.
I think Guild Wars for me, which was also 94, was that feeling of like I've played God knows how many hours of this over not only the review time but months of previews and stuff, and all I wanted to do was play it again, and that's very, very rare. I'm such a cliche in a way, but like is incredibly rare of like not even feeling. Yeah. Especially for an MMO. Never review MMOs.
Yep.
God, man. Sorry.
It's funny to remember high scores I've given. I think I gave 92 or something to Ikruga, and it scored Wild Remastered really highly as well. But then it's kind of those just proven classics, and then you play them again. It's like, yeah, this is still important and amazing. It's not that hard to give them a score.
Yeah. What have you folks been playing?
Marsh.
Tom. We've both been playing.
Yeah. Metal Gear Solid 5, The Phantom Pain.
Yeah.
If only you'd said it in unison and high five.
Yeah. Lots of people have been talking to me about it, selling me on the game, saying, no, you really should play it, even though you hate Kojima's games usually, and you think that his world is a big old stinking pile of bullshit. But you should play this, because it doesn't have any of his bullshit in it. It's no cutscenes, pretty much, and it's just this amazing open world. And it does have an amazing open world, but they're wrong that it doesn't have any cutscenes, because it begins with one which takes 70 fucking minutes. And it is partially interactive. You can kind of move the camera around, and periodically, in kind of like a tutorial sort of way, it says, oh, by the way, you can press a button to do this thing, and it lets you do it, which takes 2-3 seconds, and it says, oh, camera is mine now, and carries on directing you this nonsense, which is, it's extravagant and explosive, but it's also seemingly hallucinatory, so it doesn't really mean anything. None of the actions in it can make any sense, because it's existing in some kind of fantasy reality where people can catch fire or deflect tanks and things like this. That was not one of the worst openings to a game that I'd anticipated for the opposite of that, if you know what I mean. Like, in the way that the game had been sold to me on this kind of massively kind of open sandbox stealth in a giant desert, to have just this most trammelled, tedious opening full of Kojima's bullshit, more full of it than, I think, probably, I don't know, maybe Metal It's been a while, and certainly more than Ground Zeroes, anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, the Ground Zeroes does open with a long, unskippable.
It's not over an hour though.
It's not over an hour long. It's just the length of a full Joan Baez song.
Yeah, but I quite like Joan Baez. So that's alright.
What's frustrating about Phantom Pain's intro is that it gives you just enough interactivity to make it frustrating that you're not in control. I'd almost prefer it was a movie of some kind.
Oh yeah,
I could make a cup of tea and sit back or something. But it's then something. Oh, I've got to press A, and it's like, oh, yeah, that's even more annoying. So
it's the thing which, and Tomb Raider does this as well, where it gives you that interaction just enough that you to kind of engage your agency very briefly, and then it takes it away again. And that is such a frustrating thing to do to the player. I don't understand why they think that was acceptable. Like you said, I'd rather it was just completely non-interactive than to have that disconnect of just being yanked away from the game every few seconds. Very, very annoying.
It's very trusting in its own sense of spectacle, isn't it?
Yeah, it shouldn't be.
there is something... I've never seen some of those scenes in any game, but... That's because they're just crazy. It's because there's no kind of logic to them. I kind of don't know whether... It's all in the first sort of 70 minutes. I don't know if we can want to spoil any bits of it.
No, probably not, just in case people aren't really invested in the Kojima bullshit.
Yeah, it's funny. It reminds...
People are, you know.
Yeah, so I've heard.
Hearing you describe it, it kind of reminds me... Have you guys played The Witcher 2?
Yeah.
See, I think the beginning of The Witcher 2... is a great example of how you have this kind of semi kind of handheld kind of cinematic opening.
Is that the castle siege?
Yeah, like the castle siege. And it's a bit weird. You can play it in any order. I don't know why they did that. You should just play it in one order. But I guess they wanted to give you a little more control. You know, you have to go through these kind of set pieces and it kind of opens the story up. But you know, when you have control for an entire set piece and you have a little fight or something. And I found it to be one of the most exciting openings to any game I've ever played. I loved it so much. I don't know what it was. It's just so kind of, it's visceral and dark and, you know, and kind of, I don't know, broody. And I kind of enjoyed that. Take any prisoners. But, it just reminded me of that. So, you know, there's a great example.
Yeah, well, another counter example is the recent Wolfenstein New Order, which has a very similar setup in its introduction. And, your character is in a coma for a long period of time in Wolfenstein, and time lapse takes maybe 3 minutes probably overall the entire cutscene. Then he stabs a Nazi and he carries on stabbing Nazis for another, I don't know, 6 to 12 hours. Whereas
he goes from 0 to 60 faster than any human being does, old BJ. Is that easy? Literally in a muscular atrophy, state of muscular atrophy for a decade, and then immediately.
I do wonder
kills 50 people.
If Kojima saw that and said, that's not how muscular atrophy works. I'm going to show the player. Because I don't know, for maybe 20 minutes of it, you can't walk, you can only crawl.
No, you
And it's really boring. And you can't even crawl in a direction you choose. You can only crawl forward, and it automatically kind of guides you. If you press any other direction, it just doesn't move. Even if it's just off forward, it'll say, no, sorry, you're not pressing the right direction. That's not how muscular atrophy works.
And you have to press forward.
And then you press forward, and then he, of his own volition, climbs up something and falls off it.
What's the point of even pressing anything if there's only one thing you can press?
This is the designer that got people to climb up a ladder for the entire duration of a song.
Yeah, I mean, clearly he is a precedent for being a total asshole. The other weird thing in this is that at one point you're given a chance to make your own character, modify the bridge of his nose, change his ethnicity, change his hair, everything, and it doesn't do anything. And I don't know if that's what that means.
I think that's going to come back in the same way that you give it your name and date of birth,
right?
And you do that, and I think MGS2. And it turns up on a dog tag at the end, I think.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
I think there's some sort of long play thing going on there when you make that character.
Right. Because it just doesn't make any sense. Because shows you in the mirror the face that you're going to have, and then he shows you in the mirror again. You've got your previous face.
Yeah, exactly.
Like,
forget that.
Didn't I just have the... Wasn't I now a black dude with a giant beard?
No, you see him flying out of an explosion at the end. Final cutscene. As a guess, or not in the end.
One cool thing, though, is this is on PC, and so eventually someone will complete it and put up their save game online, where presumably it'll be possible to kind of jump in at some point.
Yeah, I did think about just extracting my save file and putting it up there for people who just aren't into that stuff.
Is there story in those first 70 minutes which you need?
Nothing that can be said in a sentence.
Yeah. So with your save file, just have a sentence. Like, yeah. You're good to go.
You woke up and you're escaped.
Yeah.
But after that, it does become as legitimately great, I think, as everybody's saying, which is a frustration of it, because, you know, I'm quite tempted just to randomly trounce it, but I can't really. And as soon as you get to Afghanistan, which is where the game seems to be set in the main, you're just given this massive landscape to roam freely on your horse and approach objectives. You have lots of different kinds of ways of implementing stealth or stealth forces. It's quite robust. Like, the AI is really good, I think, but not so kind of brutally realistic that you're constantly shtuck by it. Like, it allows itself to be suitably gamey that you can manipulate it. I don't know, how far into the kind of sandbox stuff have you got, Tom?
I went through the first sort of little mini village it encourages you to go through, which you don't even have to do. It just says, one of the things I love most about it is using your binoculars and the way it marks things out for you.
It's so generous. Nearly every other stealth game, I think, limits the number of people you can mark for spurious reasons.
For no reason, yeah.
This is, you mark anybody you can see.
And you know that there's going to be more people in that warren somewhere. So there's still that sense that you could happen across them. But
it doesn't make it too easy, I think.
Yeah, but it really does give you an opportunity to plan. And actually, I've kind of been enjoying it as an action game more than I expected.
Oh, yeah.
Because they have, like, outward-facing machine gun emplacements. And in one place, an anti-air cannon. And anti-air cannons are really good at messing people up. Just turn them around.
Turns out they're anti-human too.
Yeah, that's their side effect.
Side effect may destroy humans.
Yeah. So,
may also destroy contents of planes.
The villages are so large, and the areas around them are so large, actually crossing a plane to get to it is in itself a challenge, which is fascinating. I've never encountered that in the same way in a game before. So what I like to do so far is pick the gun emplacement, a relatively isolated one, just choke out a few guys, then turn the gun emplacement on the rest of the place. And then every time you kill someone, and one of the things I think I like about it, even though it should be quite obnoxious, is that it has this heroism thing, that it's measuring your heroism, because you're a snake, you're a legend on the battlefield, and everything you do contributes to that legend or dismantles it in some way. And whenever you kill someone, it goes, -10 heroism! And so you get points for silently choking people out and not killing them. So I do very, very well up to the point I get hold of the AA gun. And then I take such a fucking heroism hit. Unbelievable.
So, serious doubts about Snake now.
Yeah. I haven't gone loud yet. I can't do that yet. I think I'd have to... I have to fuck up in order to allow myself the luxury of killing loads of people.
Yeah.
Although I would like to. I can't bring myself to. But instead, I spend, like, many day and night cycles just looking at things through binoculars, basically, before going in.
The guy on your radio, like, I let a whole day pass like that, just kind of looking around.
Revolver Ocelot. And got lots of facts about crows, bears.
Does it?
Yeah.
Because you can look at things and just call him up about them.
He's like, what the fuck are you... Why are you asking me about crows? You can't have been in a coma for so long. You can't remember what crows are.
They weren't just invented.
he has a lot to say.
Yeah.
It's kind of impressive, though, the attention to detail. If they do let you ask about those sorts of things.
Oh, well, you can not only find out all about crows, you can abduct them and take them back to your base.
What?
You can knock
do,
the crow
do you tie
out.
A balloon to them?
Yeah. No, just pocket crows and mice. But anything larger than the crow, then you can attach, including humans, you can attach balloons to them. And they fly up in the air, and then a plane comes across and snatches them.
So how does it handle... Airlift. So I saw a video of this, and, like, he... choked a guy and they attached a balloon to him and that took him back to his base, and then he was just, like, automatically on Snake's side. How does that conversion process work?
I guess there is a brainwashing element to it, but it happens quite quickly.
Free balloon ride.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Whoa! I don't want to work for this guy.
A minute ago I was pretty down about being choked, but right now
I'd sign. Do you want to run the balloon and see my oil rig? Whee!
That should be an actual different takedown. Like, instead of choking them out, you just grab them and say, look, do you want to go on a balloon ride? I say, yes.
So I'm interested how the takedowns look for crows. Do you choke off them?
Well, I've only ever tranquilized them.
Okay.
So I don't
know. Can you do anything else with them under your pocket? Can you throw them at people? Can you?
I think there's only a pocket button. It would be awesome if you could throw crows at people as, like, a distraction.
That would be the most Kojima thing to be able to do, though, is just, like, lobbing tranquilize crows over a wall. At
is attaching balloons to bears not enough for you?
Why do you need a bear?
Obviously. Obviously you need bears.
Chief explosives expert.
I watched one guard get into an argument with some sheep. When I was just watching, he was just walking down the road and there was some sheep crossing and he just started shouting at them. And then they ran off. And I thought, they've built AI for sheep rage. That's fantastic.
Finally!
That's what we've all been waiting for. I can't wait to just find out. I have a sneaking suspicion that going loud might expose some inadequacy in the AI. I'm going to test it some more and see how it really behaves.
Only from talking to other people who've played it more, but again, these are the same people who said it didn't have any cutscenes, so take it with a pinch of salt. They've all said that the actual mega violence in the game is extremely gratifying. It's a shame if you don't do it.
Yeah,
In fact, it seems from my impression of, because I went around Rich's house and he's a lot further in it than I am. In fact, he's finished it and reviewed it, so I don't know. But at the stage he was, which was presumably several hours further than I am now, there still weren't that many new tools and tricks you could use for sign-on playthroughs, whereas he had gained loads and loads of new guns and stuff. So I don't know if it's kind of trying to encourage you to go bad. After all, the character you have now resembles a demon because he has this giant horn of shrapnel in his forehead, and there's lots of very heavy-handed references to him going to hell and becoming a demon. And coincidentally, that's also a metaphor. Because he is, in fact, as a person, becoming more and more demonic.
Mm. So clever.
It is really, the subtlety of this stuff is...
Minus 10 heroism.
Yeah. I'm literally a demon, what do you want from me?
I hope there's some kind of payoff for that morality system they've got.
That was going to be my question. Has there been any gameplay effect of that, or is it just a number?
Your horn grows.
It might be.
When you say horn.
I don't know that it doesn't, actually. But I think there is some later payoff regarding...
I'm not that far into it.
There was someone was just tweeting the scorecard, because you do get S ranks for doing Mission to Beverly.
All the best games have S ranks.
Exactly. But it seemed to be that... I might be reading this wrong... But it seems to be that in addition to how you played, and obviously it likes you more for doing stealth playthroughs and the heroic playthroughs, it also affects how the allies that you bring on your mission think of you.
Mm.
And this man got an S rank and earned a lot of approval from his horse.
Fantastic.
D horse really liked it.
Yeah, why is he called D horse?
Diamond horse.
Diamond horse, isn't it?
As opposed to diamond dogs.
Why didn't you just call it diamond horse?
D-horse.
It's not that much.
That's my answer to that.
The answer is the name. Just say it again.
D-horse. Well, it's actually quite common for naming conventions in Japanese games to have initial hyphen thing. Mm. Right? You see that all the time.
I also saw in a video. Just to reiterate, I also saw in a video that you can your staff who you've abducted with balloons.
Hmm.
You can play as them and take one of them on them, just be them for a mission.
Oh, really?
Yeah, you can.
I've got that fine.
Mm.
That sounds great. I want to do that.
You can. I mean, they all get randomly generated names, which are all, adjective animal things. So I think Sinister Woodchuck and that working before me.
S-word.
Yeah.
So I take it then you can be the bear? If you capture a bear, maybe?
I think, if I remember correctly...
Zoo, apparently.
I think when you abduct personnel, they all have a preset category, so if it's a scientist, they'll go to your research lab or something. I think only if you abduct combat personnel do they become someone you can play as.
A bear just works in the lab.
Bear should be combat personnel. Yeah. If he's going to have a division, I would think combat would be his forte.
Sleeping. Hibernation division. Yeah.
You should be able to order a bear drop.
Sounds like a weapon from Worms.
In a line, like 10 of them, one after the other.
If you're not the full max strength bear drop by abducting 10 bears, you can carpet bomb an area in bears.
Imagine the surprise of a moment after a bear lands in front of you, a second bear lands behind you. Yeah.
You say clever girl, but it's more like clever whoever arranged this.
I think it's beyond clever, yeah.
War never changes.
I think that's the dumbest quote ever. War changes loads all the time.
Yeah.
If you want to say war never goes away, sure. Mm. There's always some war.
Yeah.
But that's not the same as war never changes. War changes dramatically.
Yeah. War never changes, but in the future there are robots and lasers.
Exactly. What actually, Tim, have you been playing anything other than your game?
So yeah, not so much in the last couple of weeks, but before that, a couple of games I wanted to talk about actually. So one is I'm finally getting round to playing Final Fantasy XIII. I play every game about, well, in this case, what, 5 years after it comes out, and I never had a PS3 and blah blah blah. Poor me. Anyway, I didn't notice it's on Steam, and it's a really good port. It's run, it's really, really well optimized, in my opinion. Runs really well, and you get Japanese subtitles. Sorry, other way around. English subtitles, Japanese voice acting, which I prefer. And it's kind of great when I'm stressed after like a hard day of work or whatever, and it's like, it's like sitting on a roller coaster. You just kind of, it's cutscenes, and then, in fact, I love it. It's really well paced, I think, because what you do is you do like 10 battles against, your kind of normal kind of enemies. And you do those battles, you kind of learn, you work out new strategies to beat the best way to beat those guys. And then there's a boss fight, and you use all those strategies you've just learnt to beat the boss, and you get shed loads of experience, use that to unlock some new abilities. And then you just rinse and repeat, and you do that again and again and again with like a really ridiculous Japanese storyline to go with it. And then suddenly it opens up. And as soon as it opened up, and most people were like, this was the time the game got good, because finally it was like a Final Fantasy game, and you got to kind of run around this open world, and you got to do what you wanted. I lost interest. I loved how it was just, it was just a railroad, and it was comforting. And now I'm like, oh, and I've got to kind of do all these extra battles, and it's not as like tightly paced. I'm not getting any new abilities. And, yeah, it's interesting. I'm like, I've changed. My younger self loved, Final Fantasy 8 and 9. And especially when you get the ships and you can kind of go around or wherever you want. But strange. I'm kind of looking for something a little bit different now. The other game I've been playing is King of Dragon Pass.
Oh yeah, I've heard great things about it.
Anyone played that?
No, but I know of it. It's awesome.
So for anybody who's not heard of it, I did some research. It was first came out in 1999, developed by A-Sharp, and I could be a journalist. yeah, there was an iOS release. I can't actually remember exactly when, maybe last year or something like that. Does that sound about right? And it's also ported to Steam now, very much a mobile port to Steam, but you're not playing it for necessarily the graphics or anything like that. You're playing it because you like what it is, which is essentially a choose your own adventure book with strategic elements. So you are the leader of a clan in the fabled Dragon Pass, and it seems to be taken a lot from Norse mythology. And yeah, you can kind of do things like cattle raids, and you can raid the other clans, and that's the kind of where the strategy comes into it. And so you've got these kind of global statistics, the way I think of it as a game designer, which are attached to your game progress. But then there's these random events, which act a bit more like choose your own adventure books, where you have a number of options. And, it's actually that there where the game shines, because they've clearly linked the events that happened very closely to other events that have happened, as well as what's currently going in your strategic overgame, right? So if you've been raiding the Harani a lot, like I have, because they're weak and they have cows, and therefore those are my cows.
Catching balloons to them.
I feel like best officer.
Then one day they come over and they either seek peace or they demand ransom from you, even though, I mean, come on, I'm like beating the crap out of them. But it's so far, you know, it's I've not seen the same event twice, and it's been very, it seems to kind of match my history very well. And I think later on it's going to kind of open up and get a little bit more kind of interesting. Right now, it's kind of been the everyday running of my tribe. I have a feeling from kind of reading the intro, the kind of tutorial and stuff like that that's included in the game, that it's going to get a little bit more kind of exciting. Things are going to happen. But yeah, I really like it, and I kind of love it because I've wanted to actually make a game a bit like this, and never thought it could be commercial. And I think it's doing actually quite well. So I think it's awesome that a game in this time.
It's got quite a kind of legendary status, I think. It's probably kind of accrued over the years, by word of mouth. Do you have a sense, like, you say all the kind of choose your own bits are tailored to your history as a player. Is that just because they've written lots of different scenarios, kind of pre-cooked them, or are there kind of dynamic elements to it that are kind of slotted in to make it seem more personalised?
I think they've just written a lot of kind of dialogue. Although, I mean, they definitely slot in, you know, names.
Right.
You know, like the name of the tribe will be slotted into the one you're having a feud with and that sort of stuff. And these are like kind of simple tricks, but it works really effective. And I think the other trick they kind of use, if you can call it a trick, it's just good design, is, I think they design these long-lasting plots. And I think you have a number. This is just my, this is the feeling I get is how it works underneath. And you might start one of these plots and then you have one event and then and maybe a year later another one comes and you have another choice. And
these
seem to be kind of branching. Like I met some lizard people and I stole their dragon statue, which is apparently a very powerful treasure. It's got that kind of culty kind of feel where like, it doesn't say much about anything. It's the sort of thing where like, I bet when you're an expert, you know exactly what the dragon statue does, but all it says when you hover over it is like, this is a very powerful treasure. You know, keeping it will do good things for your village, your clan. And I'm certain that's going to come back later, but I've actually had it for like a couple of years. So I kind of like that there's a bit of a delayed effect to your actions. It's really cool. Definitely want to play some more of that.
Poor lizard people. That was the one thing they had.
I had a choice to kind of go in and properly raid them, and like obviously that would have involved slaughtering lots of lizard people. But instead, I snuck in with just a few people, which is risky because if they found me, then you know I'd have been outnumbered. But it meant I could do it without any bloodshed.
Tie a balloon to the statue, impress a horse.
No. But in fact, my clan hates dragons because that was part of my original.
Cheers, guys! I brought this statue.
And the lizard people are descended from the dragon, so it was important, I think, for me to stick true to my clan's history and steal
that shit.
Yeah,
steal the statue of the thing you hate.
It's weird. I say one more thing about it. It's one of these strange games which maybe it's all bluff. I don't know. It makes you think your actions have big effects. Like you have this section at the beginning where you answer. It's a bit like old school Elder Scrolls where you have like a few questions to like Daggerfall, I'm thinking of, if anybody's ever played that. Yeah. You answer some questions like, you know, what was the gift that you were given by your father when you were 8?
Sure.
And it's stuff about your clan's history. And it says like, you know, these things will heavily affect your gameplay experience afterwards. And you're like, wow, this is so like cool. There's so many options and it's going to really affect. I have no idea what effect it's having. So I don't know. It does some stuff very kind of interestingly by not saying too much but suggesting a lot. It makes you feel kind of very intrigued. It's very mysterious.
They did that questionnaire thing at the start of Morrowind, but it was a census form that you had to fill in for like customs.
Yes.
Like you just arrived off a ship, so you had to go through customs. And then like some of them were just like race and name and stuff. But then you also had to answer those like almost like, is it Voight-Kampff test in Blade Runner?
Yeah, yeah.
And it's like, you find a tortoise in the desert to look at the shit. And then you ask those questions, and says, oh, based on this, we've chosen Bard for you. And inevitably, 100% of the time, you're like, no, what the fuck is that? I don't want to be that. I want to be a fucking assassin.
Yeah, yeah. They get to big arrivals in Heath Throne. There's a big gate that's like nothing to declare. And the next gate is like a knight's walking through the forest.
The tortoise?
The next is one of those ink blot tests.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you see? That's, I don't know why.
Then you go through the gate at the end, and you're a bard.
Yeah. Here's your loot.
Yeah.
It declares, you have chosen bard. No, what bard? Anyone else who has something to declare, obviously.
And that has been what I've been playing.
Good. What are you in there, Chris?
I've been playing Active Aggression.
That sounds like a lifestyle.
Should we make everyone try and guess what type of game it is based on that?
Active Aggression.
We'll be here a while.
It's so
pharmaceutical management sim.
Match 3 puzzler?
I know what it is as well, actually.
Yeah, I know, so I can't.
Okay. We all know. That was a rubbish quiz.
This is easily the worst customs experience I've ever had.
You're a bard.
So, Active Aggression is a real-time strategy game by Eugen Systems, who also made Warland Air Game Battle.
Oh, sorry, you were saying Act of Aggression.
Yeah.
I thought you said Active Aggression.
No, Act of Aggression.
That's why I said it. Thought it sounded like a lifestyle.
Yeah. No, I think, so same guys made Warland Air Game Battle.
Yeah.
Warland. Airland.
Warland Battle, the Airland and Sea, with the planes
land
and the tanks.
Game. Yeah. which is quite hardcore. But I didn't realise this, about 10 years ago, they made a game called Act of War.
Mm.
And this is really a spiritual sequel to that. So it is a real-time strategy game that's either set in the near future or in 2001, depending on whether you're talking about the game or the people in the game. because it really is old school as hell. And that's the core of its appeal, right? Like, the core of its appeal is, hey, do you remember Command & Conquer Generals?
And I do.
And do you remember real-time strategy of that kind from the turn of the millennium, pretty much post-Red Alert, but pre-Supreme Commander or those kinds of, or StarCraft II even, that kind of thing. Second, you know, and a genre of game that has died off in most parts of the world quite substantially and survived in kind of, and grown more hardcore in its sort of European heartland, right? Like in the sort of Western, Northern European countries where those games are really popular, they become much more deep military sims, and this is an attempt to create something that's a little bit more like you remember, with build orders and little punchy tanks and near future cloaking tech and psychic tiny men. And I'm reviewing it, and I actually have no idea now what I'm going to really say, because I don't think I miss them. I'm now playing it, and like, oh yeah, I don't miss this. And it's interesting, because it almost speaks to the conversation we had about StarCraft 2 the other week,
yeah,
where that conversation was about how StarCraft 2 changes too much, right? Mm. Like, there are no missions in StarCraft 2 which are just StarCraft 2. They're all weird tower defense, or something else, or some crazy day-night cycle, or some, like, a gimmick. There's a gimmick in every single map that makes you play differently. And this is not that. Just to talk about the single-player campaign, I mean, the setting is, like, when I say it's near-future war, it's the year of 2025, there are PMCs, you know exactly the plot I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Like, you can all imagine that story now, because you've played it in 15 million different games. It's, you know, airport, military, fiction, potboiler, Clancy-verse. And that's that. And I hate to be dismissive, but really is. Yeah. That's what that's.
They've earned that dismissal, I think.
Yeah, that's what that is. And I mean, you know, it's easy to make fun of. Like, the cutscenes are done with, like, stock photography of people and some stock footage of stuff, as if everything's a news report, even, like, military briefings to each other. Because, like, military commanders being given briefings by the news. I mean, not to let you know, for events, and some really appalling voice acting. And, like, your mission instructor is just a very heavily show photoshopped photo of a woman who pops up to go, "Commander! The PMC and the something. Oh my god, a train." And
sounded like a briefing from Eddie Izzard.
Yes.
And a big shrug. But yeah, and like, and some very funny, appalling voice acting, and some other just really frustrating stuff. It's really frustrating because you play as the goody faction, the good guys, or like the UN, but the UN are called the Chimera. They get like an edgy rebranding.
They sound like the bad guys.
Yeah. No, the bad guys are the cartel. And this is really
like, I shouldn't have called themselves that. Yeah.
If you look at the box, or if you read the description of the factions, or indeed play any of the cartel missions before you can play them in any order. You're told very clearly that the cartel are a secretive coalition of PMCs that have kind of bonded together to create the ultimate PMC that's also bad. Who knows? Probably EMPs. But the first hour, X amount of time that feels too long, of the Chimera campaign is finding out what's going on with all these PMCs. And it's just people in these shit photo collage cutscenes saying to each other, "But this PMC was involved in Mexico, and this PMC was involved in Russia. They couldn't possibly be working together." which is a bit like having the StarCraft campaign open with people questioning if the Zerg really exist.
Yeah.
Where you're like, no, they do. They're on the box. So you can skip that. But that's kind of disposable. The structure of the campaign is that old school RTS thing of increasingly complicated tasks until they give you full base management. But you play through a shitload of missions where it's like, in this one, you've got 6 soldiers and you're going to click all the waypoints until you get to the end. And then it ends. And then eventually you get to the point where you're being given units and you're being drip-fed more of the tech tree. Mm-hmm. And eventually you've got all the tech tree. And I remember loving this when I was 15 years old, because I think I just wanted to watch the FMV in Red Alert. Essentially, like, I was just clicking on waypoints in return for a picture of Carrie Wooher circa 1997, because teenager things. And like, but now there's not that, right? Like, it doesn't have any of that appeal. So I eventually just got really, really fucking tired of the campaign and just went to play skirmishes, which is where the game actually is, and it's clearly what it's designed for, and it wants to be a multiplayer game of that type. And in that regard, it's good, I think. Like, it's so hard to judge in a way, because it feels like a game that's destined to attract a really, really hardcore fan base that really get it and can see how its internal systems fit together. For me, it is different enough to be something I'm having to relearn. Like, it doesn't necessarily call on your Command and Conquer knowledge or StarCraft knowledge, but exactly the same as everything I've ever played enough to feel like I've done it before, which is a tricky balance to strike. And I think that'll either be something people love, because it's like, hey, this is a refresh of a formula I love, and I can spend a bit of time reinvesting in this form of real-time strategy. Or it's like, actually, I kind of now realize why I moved on to something faster in StarCraft, or bigger in Supreme Commander, or in a bunch of different directions. You know, when I say it's got some interesting ideas of its own, like, you set up these bases and each faction builds bases slightly differently, but still within the remit of spend resources, make building, make unit, push for buildings. But it randomly places where the mineral fields are on every map, and you have to send a little survey drone around to find them. And that affects where you expand to. So that removes the kind of complete precision that defines StarCraft from the occasion, or even maybe Supreme Commander. There's a sort of a moment of scrabbling, or maybe luck. And I haven't really played enough of it to get a sense of exactly how much that affects the balance of the game necessarily, in terms of, like, can you just luck out at the start and get a set of mineral patches that enables a push strategy you wouldn't otherwise have. But it's at least interesting, and it changes the way the start of games can feel. There's quite a lot of emphasis on fighting over urban areas by garrisoning buildings, which makes things feel slightly different. I don't know how this works, but you can get a steady drip feed of oil by making 6 marines garrison a bank. And I don't really know what they're doing when they're in that bank. So there's no civilian traffic, which suggests that, even though you're fighting in urban areas, that suggests that the cities are abandoned. Mm. If the cities are not abandoned, then you can presume that the soldiers are holding the bankers hostage and forcing them to siphon off money or something, and you're spending that on oil. If they're not, if the cities are abandoned, are those soldiers actually doing the banking? Do you send them in there to, like, take over the operations of the daily work of the bank, then periodically fire rocket launchers out the window?
I thought I might be in there just applying millions of tons of pressure to seashells for a very long period of time.
Yeah, exactly.
Ultimately arriving at,
I mean, because in other ways, like, obviously it abstracts some of the, you know, the processes of military industrial production by having you actually extract oil on the battlefield with refineries and actually refine your own aluminium and so on, rather than using supply lines, which suggests that maybe that's just there to simulate, like, the kind of the financial industry role in the support of a military industrial complex. I don't know, basically, but that's probably the most interesting set of thoughts I've had about that game.
What are those 6 marines doing?
Yeah, what are they doing in there? Apart from they occasionally fire out the window or die. If they get, you know, boarded.
Banking is
boarded. What's the word if you counter enter a building that someone else is in? Garrisoning is when you go in by yourself.
Raided.
Or
occupied.
Counter entered.
Counter entered. Try to think what else, like.
I've been looking forward to this game, and so I'm, you know, obviously it might just be kind of taste and that sort of stuff, but I'm a little worried, you know. I'm like, oh no, what if it's not so good? See, where I am with real time strategy at the moment, like, I grew up in real time strategy, like StarCraft 1, I just played to death so much. You play multiplayer LAN with my friends and my family. It's one game my dad played. It's awesome. And then StarCraft 2, I played through Wings of Liberty campaign, and I watch a ton of it, competitive stuff online, but I can't play it. I can't play it multiplayer. I'm too bad. It's too fast for me. Like, I skipped my practice matches because I actually won the first 3 of those when I first went to the ladder. And then it goes from, like, average speed to, like, faster or fastest or whatever StarCraft 2 plays at. And, like, it just ruined me. Like, it just goes way too fast for me. And I was thinking, maybe this is, like, a Command & Conquer Generals experience. A game I can actually play and not just enjoy for its amazing balance and, like, intricacies and skill level, you know?
I mean, it might well be that. And I want to play a bit more as humans. Because at the moment, I've been playing in a pre-release period. I've been playing as bots just to learn the game because I don't feel like I know enough. And a lot of the games I'm playing against bots, whether I win or lose, seem to end before I get to, like, the mid-game. So, like, I'm playing a bit more to see more of the end-game units and stuff. But, like, you know, it's a big tank and a nuke, right? It's still in that kind of similar. I kind of know how this power-up goes, right?
Yeah.
But the reason I hadn't played too much against people, even to learn, was I have found the community that's in... There's, like, a global chat channel for this game. Tom was in the office when this happened. This was amazing. There's a global chat channel for the game, which at the moment I think is just the beta testers. And there is a lot of German spoken in that channel. And I don't want to make any assumptions, national assumptions, based on the kind of places where games are popular. But real-time strategy really did survive in Germany in ways it didn't elsewhere, so there's that. But the community that I have been listening to in that game is fucking terrifying. And I play a lot of Dota, right? Like, I'm used to scary, aggressive communities. They're not aggressive. They're really serious. And it made me worry that I'm wandering into this environment of, like, really serious wargame fans, where I am just going to be a tiny child in comparison to them. And, because the reason for this was, somebody was, like, saying, like, I'll paraphrase, but one guy was like, in relative internet speak, like, ah, this, you know, rush strat's so broken, man. You know, you just win every time if you rush. And this guy responds with an essay, like an actual essay pasted line by line into this chat box in sort of broken English. Well, maybe English is a second language, but in a kind of almost florid, kind of serious prose, saying, rush strats are not broken. I understand why you see that. But in truth, the reason you think that is because Europe, motherland Europe, hasn't bred any true generals since Caesar. In many ways, we're all shadows of humanity's great proficiency at war, now sadly drained. Anyway, here's a forum link to my strategy guide. And it was amazing. It was like a fucking Kojima monologue at that point. It was like, you know, like, there are no true warriors anymore, so forgive yourself, friend, for believing that the early Humvee rush strat is overpowered. For in truth, no one of your generation could be expected to truly understand war. And then the next guy's response was just, gay game.
And there's both extreme.
Yeah, and it was like, video game. And so that's why I haven't played Active Aggression online yet. Because I don't want to get matched against that guy. Because it's either going
or
to be awful,
other guy, really.
Or like, either of them. But like, I don't want to get matched against Transcendental Nature of War guy. Because I'm worried that it will either be terrible, or I will join a cult at the end of that. I'm like, no, this is true. I truly don't understand the nature of war. Teach me.
Or even better, the Humvee rush strat is legit, and you just fuck him up with it.
Yeah,
back.
Does it have cool general powers, like Command & Conquer generals?
No. Who your general is doesn't really seem to affect anything.
And you don't get to, like, call down airstrikes and stuff?
You
like
do. So that's a cool thing I like about it.
Okay.
So you can specialise your... So generals had, like, the individual army specialisations based on the specific general. So I forgot the name of the factions and generals now.
There's GLA, who are like the terrorists, and then you've got China and everyone else.
Yeah.
I guess
West of Europe, America.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you could like pick like the Air Force specialization or the tank specialization. That kind of exists in a softer form within what order you get things from the tech trees.
Okay.
So you can, like, if you play as the Chimera, you can choose to opt for the sword or the shield approach, which affects whether you get defensive or offensive abilities. The assumption is you'll eventually get both, but it affects how you play into the mid-game. There's loads of interesting stuff. Like, don't get me wrong, there's loads of interesting stuff. It's just that where it is new, it's subtle gradations on top of things you've kind of seen before. But I really do like the way it does planes, because I think planes in generals and in quite a lot of strategy games sit in this really weird zone where Supreme Commander can get away with them because the maps are so big you can kind of have relatively realistic aircraft. Even though they're little robots that will just sit down somewhere and you're not using them and then take off and whiz all the way.
Adorable.
StarCraft settles it by having all planes also be helicopters, also be flying floaty drones, right? They just hover over wherever they're going. And this game has helicopters, which act more like regular units. When you build an airbase, you then queue up what configuration of planes you want, which could be like, there are drones, there are superiority fighters and bombers. And then those things act almost like global abilities that you then have on call at any time. So if you have a wing of superiority fighters, for example, like, you just don't want to deal with helicopters and you don't want to build anti-helicopter tanks, so you just have this thing, they sit off the map, and then when you need them, like a button on the side of the screen, then you plan their route and they come flying in off the side of the screen to do whatever it is you want them to do and then fly off again. They can be shot down or destroyed, or you can tell them to go back, but they almost act like these special abilities, which is kind of, it's a neat thing, because it's harder to factor in when planning an assault. They do fly very slowly for planes, but as a, you know, it's an interesting kind of abstraction. There are a few other nice things, like, if you zoom out to the furthest zoom view, you get, like, a top-level tactical analysis of the map, but it looks like a kind of drone, black-and-white drone shaky cam thing, which is kind of cool. There's a lot of stuff in it that's kind of like, eh. But, and I think that's probably exactly what some people want. I think for me, it was like, it just made me realise a bunch of the things that I maybe didn't feel like I had the time to invest in having experience I felt like I've already had to such a substantial degree.
That's a fair point, yeah.
I've already talked about Big Pharma a bunch, but I want to give a quick shout out to a very similar game, Skipping Stones to Lonely Homes. Like, oh, yeah. Active aggression. is top down.
Nice segue.
So it's the new game from Alan Hazelden, who did Good Snowman is Hard to Build and Soccer Bond and some other games. Mirror Isle I've talked about a lot on this, and God, I've actually pimped his games a lot here, because I also talked about You're Pulleying My Leg, which is the very complicated side-on, like, light reflecting one. This one is top-down, and it's just on islands, and right at the start of the game, your ship has become shipwrecked on the island, and you've got to get some wood to repair it. And that's your only objective of the game, and really the objective is to get from this island to the next island, and then when you get to that one, you'll get to the next one. And the way you do it is there's lily pads and there's rocks, and that's more or less the only two things in the game. And if you nudge a rock, you push them around the same way you do in any kind of, like, Sokoban style game, which is most games made in Puzzle Script, which is, you know, you walk into them and then they go along with you, but there's no way to pull them back. And if you push it to the edge of the island and it goes into the water, you automatically kind of, I guess, throw it or kick it. So that it skips across the water, and it skips in that direction without limit. It just keeps going until it either leaves the screen or hits some land. But if it goes past a lily pad, then the current of it skipping past pushes the lily pad laterally, like away from its path, so perpendicular to the direction it's going in. And so you can use that to throw a stone past a lily pad and push the lily pad towards the land, and then get on the lily pad and cross to the next island. Or you can throw a stone at the lily pad, and then it will land on the lily pad and push the lily pad away with it, so it will kind of go with the lily pad. And it sounds ridiculous to say, but I think that's it. I think that's all of the mechanics. There are also currents in the sea, so you can, like, if you push a lily pad into the current, then it will follow that current, and the current's just kind of a path, basically, that will either lead off-screen or to another island. And the weird thing about it, relative to other games, is that it's basically all one big world. All of the level, there's no discrete levels. There's just, if you push a stone off one level and it goes off screen, it will arrive on the next, on the screen in that direction. And maybe that's a screen you'll never go to, or maybe it's the next puzzle. And luckily, that is not relevant, really. Like, you can do that, but it's almost never, there aren't really puzzles that span multiple screens. I was always terrified it was going to do that to me. Like, every time I came to a puzzle, I'm like, this seems difficult. Do I have to bring something from the last screen, or should I have pushed something in some special way that would have arrived on here? And it never does that, but sometimes the puzzle is like, well, you arrive on this, like, you've got to the next screen, but you have nothing. There's no stones on your island. And so you know right away, there's literally nothing I can do. If there's no stones on your island, there are no other interactions in the game other than pushing stones around. Therefore, you can't do anything. So you know that the puzzle is to bring a stone with you in some way. And that's the only thing it ever is, really, is, like, the puzzle might be to bring a stone to the next screen. And I was also always terrified it was going to be too hard for me, because he said it was, like, one of the hardest things he'd done in a long time. And I think he's referring to the fact that there's treasure. And I never even saw any treasure, let alone found, like, got to it. Like, and I think that's a consequence of the kind of the open worldy stuff. Like, when I'm saying you don't ever have to worry about pushing things off screen to get to the next, to modify some future puzzle, I suspect if you want the treasure, you probably do. But the main objective is just to repair your ship, which involves getting to a... You've got to find some wood. And it tells you that at the start of the game. And that's the premise of the game. But then, as I say, all you're really trying to do in the short term is get to the next island. I did that. Did that loads. I spent, like, on and off probably, like, a weekend on it. And I would always get stuck and always take a break and always come back to it and always have a new insight and figure it out. And it's very satisfying, like a lot of his stuff. And then I got to this one kind of, like, strange puzzle that I sort of solved, but it wasn't really clear what I was trying to do exactly. There was an island with a tree on it, and two islands without a tree on it, and I was on one of the non-tree islands, and I had a few rocks, and I pushed them about, and I managed to divert a current, and then I stood on a lily pad. And often you can kind of, like, just race off the screen, like, you stand on a lily pad, and the current takes you away from the screen and goes somewhere else. Sometimes it ends in a big whirlpool of death, and sometimes it doesn't. And so you do it and find out where it goes, and then you undo your actions and go back. And I did that, and I just got to an island, and there's just nothing on it, and then I went to the next screen, and there was more islands, and I could get to them. And they were sometimes, like, bridged by lily pads. There'd be two lily pads connecting them, but there's just nothing there except lily pads. And there was always a really easy route to the next
island. And I kept going back past these things and thinking, this is strange. It almost feels like the game's broken or something. Because there's just all these empty islands. There's nothing to do. There's no rocks to push around. It's all sold for me already. And then I got to a ship that was shipwrecked on the island. And I realized, that's my ship. I've just gone through all of the levels in reverse order and walked over my own solutions, which I made. I put all those lily pads there. I cleared all the rocks off. I'm the one who made all this sort of boring empty space. And I realized, oh yeah, there was a tree back there. I was supposed to be getting wood. And then ran all the way back, got to the tree, and then you just get some wood from the tree, and that's it.
And then you completed it.
Yeah. I just forgot what I was doing in the game. But yeah, it's really satisfying. He says it's very hard. I think he's just referring to the treasure. I don't think it was... It's about as hard as Mirror Isle. If you played that, if you didn't, then you should play that, because that's also genius. Yeah, he makes great stuff, and it's free. Good Snowman is Hard to Build and Soccer Bond are both commercial things, but everything else he does is free, and he's supported by Patreon. And after Skipping Stones, I decided I should actually be backing our Patreon, because almost everything he releases is like an awesome thing, and it ends up entertaining you for ages.
Wicked.
Should we do questions?
Sure. Alex writes, "Dear Mr. Crate and Ms. Crowbar.com, a friend of mine is deaf in one ear, and as a result, he struggles with hearing everything that happens in games, often relying solely on subtitles when gaming. A few years ago, he played Portal for the first time, and knowing it was a puzzle game, he figured that he wouldn't need to wrestle with his hearing and simply switch the audio off. He did not, however, activate subtitles. As a result, he thought Portal was a fairly smart but quite dull and extremely short puzzle game that ended abruptly in a, spoiler warning, fire pit. He remained confused about its popularity until Portal 2 came out, gave that a try with sound, and realised there was a whole comic side to the game that he'd completely missed. What have you missed a key theme or mechanic? When have you missed a key theme or mechanic of a game, leading you to either not enjoy it or dismiss it outright? Thank you for the wonderful podcast, Alex McHugh." I wanted to read this partly because it's a good story, but also partly because it reminds me of when Pip started playing Dota. The only thing she had that would run it was a MacBook boot camping to Windows, and she could either have her headphones plugged into the game or plugged into her phone to use Skype on her phone for voice chat, which is the ghetto setup, and that meant that she didn't hear like Dota's in-game sound for 600 hours of that game. Wow. Or something along those lines, like a lot of Dota time. And it's not as big a deal as missing out on the humor in Portal, but you miss out on so much of the character. And like there's a lot of effort going into recording voice lines, as I've spoken about before, and to provide an otherwise very hardcore game with a bit of a softer edge by adding personality and humor to it. And you miss out on all of that, and the whole thing, I think, probably seems a lot scarier and more hardcore than it needs to. But it's an interesting example of something being offset to sound that you couldn't even solve for subtitles. It's just, we just entirely offset the humour and friendliness of this game onto the incidental voice lines that won't be subtitled.
Yeah.
I misunderstood the movement systems in Chaos Theory, Splinter Cell Chaos Theory, for a while, for the tutorial, but it was enough, that you move at a very slow pace, and you scroll up the mouse wheel in order to be able to speed up. So it was the game's attempt to replicate analog control in a binary PC setup. Except I didn't realise this and spent most of the game crawling around at the slowest possible. But like, what the fuck's up with this movement speed? God damn it, I can't sneak up on anyone. And then I realised that I was the idiot. So I assume that I'm the idiot now.
Twist. That was a weird fucking control system in your defense.
That problem needs solving though, because actually it's weird playing The Phantom Pain, trying to play with the mouse and keyboard setup. You really need the analog control over how fast you're moving in stealth.
Right.
So it feels like something that was worth trying to solve.
Is there just like a stealth key?
You can crouch, it's various different degrees. So you can be lying on the floor, you can be crouched, or you can be standing up. But if you have an analog control stick, you can move. There are degrees of speed within that you can access that you can't with a mouse and keyboard.
I remember reading the manual to a shitty, I think like a 3D platformer, I want to say it was a Pitfall game that had been ported to PC, and the manual said that in order to move slower, you should press the W key slightly less. Like, press it fully if you want to go full speed, but press it only like halfway if you want to go like half speed. I don't think... I don't think you know about computers.
Metal Gear Solid 3 has a, Ron Kojima to say a lot, so these are all coming to me, but, has a terrible, terrible control system with a pad, where I think the PS2 had a degree of, like, you could press the X button strongly or lightly, and that was the difference between choking a man into temporary sleep or killing him forever by breaking his neck. Depending on how hard you press that, it was so inconsistent that I'd constantly be killing people that you never
the
needed
fragility
to.
Of
at least
life.
Big Boss now actually has a robot arm that he can blame for that.
Kill setting.
Yeah, it's like, oh, sorry.
Oh, no.
Getting used to it.
That's probably a real thing. I think, like, a lot of left methods of rendering someone unconscious are actually quite dangerous and might kill them, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Lots everyone's of light different. To the brain for a certain amount of time. And
yeah. Yeah. Find the one guard with the paper mache spine. Do you have one, sir?
Tim? No, I can't think of one, no.
Fair enough. Scott C. writes, hey gang, I'm listening to the latest episode 107 when Graham is talking about Superhot. It grabbed me when he mentioned the flash that appears on screen whenever you kill an enemy, giving an example of throwing a sword at someone and turning away to deal with others, relying on the UI to confirm the kill. It does feel cool to not even watch the death you're guaranteed to have caused. And this got me thinking, which is probably the most video game sentence we've got so far. This is a common trope in cinema. There's even a song about it, showing lots of examples in action films. Provide the link, put in the show notes. And it's in traditional samurai classics or anime too. Think about the typical duel between two warriors where they both leap into the air, there's a slice, and they end up facing away from one another, usually the one in the background slumping down dead, starting a cause and effect chain which will lead to destruction, and not even to bothering watch. Sorry. Starting a cause and effect chain which will lead to destruction and not even bothering to watch oozes confidence. Turns out a lot of my favourite moment in games do this too, but they rely on showing you the results purely through the UI. In Guild Wars 2, there's loads of times in PvP where I've downed an opponent, thrown skills doing damage over time at them to finish them off, and then run off to help my team, half my brain waiting for the text confirmation of the kill to pop up. Dynasty Warriors is another example, with a good eighth of the screen constantly taken up with a KO counter. Again, this enables you to cut a line through an enemy army and not even stick around to see the aftermath. The counter will tell you exactly what you need to know. And finally, Hitman. One of my greatest experiences was completing Blood Money on the hardest difficulty, but I hardly ever witnessed any of my own assassinations. It was cold, cruel, calculating, and brilliant to set up the kill, run halfway across the map, and then have the game tell me that I'm successful. So, the questions. Although these are amazing experiences, isn't it a bit counterintuitive that they rely on the UA... The UI.
That is counterintuitive.
Yeah. The user interface confirming... an interface for ants confirming success to them confirming success to the player. It's literally telling, not showing. Do you have any more examples of this? Why does it feel so much cooler to just commit an act and walk away? This ran far too long. Please don't tell me off, Scott.
No, that's a good point.
I don't think it does feel bad to have it confirmed by the UI, though. I think no, it's because it's a game rather than just a kind of shapeless fiction.
Almost anyone giving you advice on how to design these things will say, show, don't tell, and, you know, avoid doing things in UE that you can do naturalistically.
But yeah. Then Scott gave loads of examples just then as to why that is not such.
Yeah, always... I think Scott said it great. Like, it's that confidence factor, isn't it? It's like it's turning away and saying, like, I don't even need to watch this. I know it's going to go in.
There's still, I wonder, because there is also a way to do it still using UI, but, like, let's say every time you kill a target in Hitman, it does a picture-in-picture little cutaway shot and shows you them dying. Hmm. That would be less UI-like, although it's still obviously part of the UI.
Oh, sure, well, yeah.
Would that feel less cool than getting text notification?
I thought his point was that you shouldn't have any kind of confirmation that you've done it, but you should know somehow anyway.
I think it's talking about things where it does confirm, where the game tells you.
But this is the interesting point, I think. So if you think about what the fantasy of that swordsman slicing the guy in half and looking the other way. Yeah. The fantasy there is that person is so expert a swordsman,
he knows
they don't even have to look.
Mm. Exactly, yeah.
And that's the thing games struggle to employ, because systems are very rarely that granular, and the degrees between success and failure are never... You know what I mean?
There's just not that kind of level of communication about the physicality of a game world that you can possibly have as a player. It has to have a shortcut, and you doing a UI is probably the least intrusive way of doing that.
Mm. But it's interesting, because it also changes the way games are designed. There are shooters that don't... Like DayZ is an example of one. I think there are others. Intruder is another example where the UI doesn't confirm anything about a kill. So Intruder is an in-development team-based shooter where one team is guards, the other team is intruders. And if you shoot somebody, they'll fall down, and you might see some blood, but there's no guarantee that they're dead. And every player in the game has a ragdoll me button, which allows you to fall over and flop to the ground. So there is no confirmation that you've even hit them. They could have just very smartly timed their thing, and that becomes an entire game mechanic that's brilliant. And actually becomes very risky to attempt the shoot someone. Like, in that game, if you shoot somebody and turn away knowing you've killed them, you are fucking confident. And it actually means something, because you know that you shot them in the head. And you actually are expressing that same confidence in that scenario, because the UI is confirming it. It but requires that cockiness.
I think because of that, I would never have that confidence. Yeah, I would never have that experience. Whereas in games where it does tell you, I can have that moment where I set up the kill and then look away and I feel confident, and the game tells me, yeah, you're right to be confident. You're fucking on.
That's what I'm saying, is that what I think the answer is better feedback, better, more granular feedback. Because then, rather than needing the shortcut, what you have is, like, so, you know, Intruder has, you know, pretty rudimentary graphics, and it has a blood splatter for if you shoot somebody. But, you know, like, if it had a different effect for shooting somebody in the head, it was always a headshot. Because, you know, shooting somebody in the head with a gun has a very specific effect on their head, for example. Then you could do the turn away knowing that. You know what I mean? Like, because the feedback, you're not relying on a level of abstraction in the feedback that means you could be wrong, which is the thing that causes that lack of confidence in the first place. Presumably that also applies to the sword fighting thing. Like, in a sword fighting game where you're whittling down health bars, if you remove the health bars, you don't know the other person's dead until you've really confirmed it. Unless you have a really good granular feedback model based on visible modeling of the damage, at which point when you see your broadsword go all the way through somebody, you know you've won, and you can then turn away and look cool, right? Because, and that's what I'm saying, like, it always comes back to just the degree of fidelity with which you're modelling damage, as far as I can tell.
Yeah. You can never do that action movie thing, though, of shooting somebody while not even looking at them. Like that.
Except in Cliffy B's new
game. Except in Cliffy B's new thing.
Can you?
Yeah, you can fly backwards with your head.
Oh, yeah. True. But I bet that has a brink when you kill somebody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the game designed for a blip-blip effect. Blip-blip points.
I think that's what he said in his talk. I'm designing this for the blip-blip.
I think we're just way too used to having the confirmation via the UI, and I think I'm addicted to it. And I think
I need it.
If you didn't have that, even if it was like your example of him putting the broadsword through him, I think I would be like, oh, where's my little? I want my little killer in the bottom left, and I wanted to, you know, like, oh, yeah, I don't know. It creates
a game that's then about tension and uncertainty, which you might not always want.
So
Red Orchestra has this very good version of the not knowing if you kill someone system, which is completely correct for the scene of being in, you know, Stalin war at that period. In the dark in a city that's half bombed out, and that works brilliantly. But then the Hitman thing is perfect, because that, just the posture and the way that Agent 47 walks around suggests the sort of nonchalant killer badass that you're supposed to be, and that's the ultimate kind of communication of it. If you manage to kill someone without you looking and being several streets away when it happens,
and stuff like, you know, planting your remote explosive in the office of the guy when he's not there, and then like 5 minutes later when you think, going by his schedule, he should be there, and you press the detonator. If it never told you, apart from anything else, it'd be difficult to know whether the level could end or not.
Can I leave?
But also, like, even if, let's say, you can only leave the level if the target has died, and so you can find out by trying to leave the level, it's still not as cool as it actually telling you the moment it happens. Like, if that explosion goes off and you just get a little notification just saying mission complete or whatever. Mm. I almost think, like, the more subtle, the better. Earlier I said, like, you could do it with a picture-in-picture cam. But in a way, it's kind of cooler if you don't. If it just says, objective complete. And it, like, it needs to be, I think, the more indirect, the better. So if it says, this target was killed with this explosive device, that's not very cool. But if it just says, mission complete, then that's cool, because you know what happened.
And then you have the newspaper that pops up after the mission actually goes into more detail about it.
Police suspect blood money was involved.
Yeah. Or have NPCs shout really specific things based on the nature of the event that's happened. A bomb has gone off over there.
Oh my god, I can't believe that remote detonated explosive genuinely killed the target, completing the mission for you.
But I was thinking of that because, I play almost a foray into console land, but I think it applies to any shooter. Play a lot of competitive Destiny, and one of the things you rely on in that game is you throw a grenade around a corner, and if it goes off and it hurts somebody, which you can tell by the reticle bloom, you know, there's somebody there, whereas it could have just gone off, and there's actually no real sound difference, because you're always hearing yells and screams of people getting shot. So they would need to either change that so that if they got rid of the reticle bloom, in order to have the same gameplay effect, you'd need to actually have the guy around that corner shout, "Oh God, I've been hurt by a grenade!"
Thrown by you.
Because if it wasn't, you know, if it wasn't specific, you wouldn't know it was you that had achieved it. So
yeah, sure.
It was like, "Oh, you bastard!" That.
What an annoying grenade.
It hasn't killed me, but it's me a bit.
I'm still able to speak.
It's taken me to about half my life force
fail. I'm non-lethally inconvenienced by this grenade. So yeah, maybe you guys
cries of war still haunt me to this day.
Mark writes, "Dear Crate and Crowbar, in episode 6,
wow.
I don't know. Don't judge. I've been bored recently," he writes. Oh, great. "Chris promised to make the game Zombie Cops to release in 2015. Shit.
There's still time.
2013 me doesn't appreciate this. Zombie Cops was to combine the stupidity of zombies with the stupidity of cops in Payday 2.
Right.
How far is Chris in this venture? Has Tom F. been helping out? Will Marsh's artwork create the most aesthetically terrifying zombie crime simulator of all time? Yours in constant suspense. Mark." I don't remember promising to do this. Like most things I promised to do in 2013.
Troubled development process then.
Yeah, it's troubled. I'll be refunding Kickstarter backers within some point in the next 3 months. And if you've already had your pledge refunded, then you have no right to sue me, Derek Smart.
I don't think this guy's been waiting since 2013. Since
I don't think he has either.
It seemed to imply they're just listening to it. They've gone back to episode 6 just recently.
I don't know what you would even do in Zombie Cops that wasn't Payday 2. I think that game already exists. I think if you want that game, you can go and play Payday, which is exactly that game.
I don't remember any of your promises for it. But I will help you make it if you want to jam it.
Yeah?
Yeah, you will need to find some decoder.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, like, neither of us have any of the applicable skills.
Don't point at me.
Did we just re-announce this game?
Do we just promise it again?
Yeah, 2017.
Yeah, 2017, it's on.
Yeah, 2017, sorry. Your Kickstarter back. Your pledges will not be refunded. We've rescaled, we've rescoped, we're excited about the new directions that you're continuing.
The new social features that we're implementing.
We didn't promise. Nobody sets out to make an MMO. Some people just do. I hope you're as excited as I am by Zombie Cops Universe.
Okay,
the only fully open world procedurally generated zombie cops sandbox space MMO.
Every atom is procedural.
Every atom, every zombie cop procedural.
Every
police zombie police procedural, they'll call it.
Oh.
I'm sorry.
That probably just about answers my little follow up question, which is, in today's video game ecosystem, what is the equivalent of zombie cops? What's the thing that's been done to death?
There is no equivalent. That's why we're making it, goddammit. That's why it's going to be a flight success.
If the market had already sufficiently answered demand for zombie cops, we wouldn't have received one email cops in two years since the announcement of zombie cops.
2 years later, yes.
Inundated.
Yeah, I mean, the development has been slowed down quite a lot by Tom's insistence on making and releasing one video game and continuing to make another one, and also playing your video game. So, yeah,
it's been tough.
Stalled. But
it's probably still zombies, unfortunately.
Yeah, it probably is still zombies.
We should aim for an untextured gun render by 2017.
The staple of mod progression.
Yeah, and then we can write our tearful projects going nowhere post in 2018, and then finally disband our Planet Half-Life microsite in 2020.
Up to the minute references here.
Yeah. Those are all the questions we have time for.
Well then.
Catching Tom by surprise.
You can send us questions at questions@crateandcrowbar.com. You can tweet them at us. We are @crateandcrowbar on Twitter. You can write them on our forum. We are crateandcrowbar.com/forum. And you can follow us individually if that's the only other thing to say. I am Pentadact on Twitter, PentaDact.
I'm Marsh Davis. That's DAVIES.
I'm PCG Ludo, LUDO.
C Thurston, that's C-T-H-U-R-S-T-E-N.
And I'm at Twice Circled, which is T-W-I-C-E-C-I-R-C-L-E-D.
Those are normal words.
Just search for Big Pharma, though, because, yeah, that's really the only reason to come and look at me, to be honest. And obviously my face. If you're into that.
Is that? Oh, yeah, that is only Twitter profile. Yeah, okay.
Do we mention Patreon?
That checks out.
Do we mention Patreon?
Yeah.
Not yet.
Oh, there you go.
You can, if you so wish. Throw us some money per episode on Patreon. That's how that works. And thank you so much for all those who have. It's been way more than we thought.
How would you find that?
That would be patreon.com/Crate and Crowbar.
It would.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thank you for listening, everybody.
I already did it correctly.
I know, but I thought I'd...
We didn't join in. It was too fast. You're so lightning quick.
Should we do it again?
Okay.
Thanks for listening, everybody.
Got it properly that time.
Good.
It has to be, like, shit enough. Otherwise, we can't finish the podcast.